Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the Islamic Pulse talk show. We are talking about the recent developments in Syria. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the Islamic Pulse talk show. We are here in the studio talking about some of the recent developments that are occurring in Syria. In order to talk a little bit about these recent developments, we decided to invite Sayyid Sarbaz Ruhullah Rizvi, who is from Kashmir, but he's also a political analyst who has been in the field for multiple years. We invite him and start the talk show. Sayyid, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Islamic Pulse talk show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for inviting me to be here with you.
Jazakallah, thank you for taking time out. You know, we have recently seen these developments in Syria. Of course, in a matter of week, it seems like the whole country has turned over. We've seen the amount of influence that the media has had throughout this campaign. So we wanted to really start off and just talk about a little bit about these recent developments that have occurred in Syria, some of these facts on the ground, what exactly is going on, and well, we'll continue the discussion from there. We hand it over to you in the name of Allah.
Yeah, I think all those who have been following the news of the region, the West Asian region, they are facing, you know, every day something new is coming, like in last like 14 months.
Yes.
Our region is totally different.
I mean, yes.
It started with Tufan al-Aqsa on 7th of October 2023. It continued on 8th of October, one day after that, with Lebanon starting a front in support of the Palestinian. Then it continued for 1 year. Then we faced the ground aggression of the Israelis on Lebanon. Then it resulted after more than 60 days of, you know, defeat for the Israelis,
of course,
failed attempts of the Israelis. They finally signed the ceasefire. And the day that the ceasefire was signed, events started in the Syrian part. So it all started from Idlib, which was an area under the control of We can't mention one single name, but at the end it was generally speaking under the control of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS known in English, which is actually considered to be the Al-Qaeda branch in Syria. The one who is running this Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Muhammad al-Julani, who's main name is Ahmed Hussein al-Shara, born in, if I'm not wrong, in Saudi Arabia. There are some doubts about where he was born, but the guy was a part of Daesh ISIS.
Yeah.
He actually came to Syria to start the wing of Daesh in Syria in 2013, and then it continued gradually shifted, and this is the nature of these terrorist takfiri groups, that they are, you know, there is an evolution, that, but unfortunately not evolution towards completion, but you know, sort of devolution actually.
It's like a version 2.0. It's interesting, I was speaking with some of the brothers about this, and how this individual, the militant commander Jolani, he's much more clean-cut. He's younger than, for example, Abu Bakr Baghdadi or Osama bin Laden. And so it seems like, I don't know, maybe we'll get into some of this, that the connections that these individuals have with foreign intelligence services, you know, which is clear when you see some of these things. But how they have refined this individual now, he doesn't have this bloodthirsty, savage type of, you know, persona that he's trying. He's trying to be like he's some kind of a global leader, except that he's a militant commander.
Yeah, this is what they are trying to do it now. This is their new face.
Yeah.
But the same guy, the guy is the same one that has, you know, that had done, you know, atrocities against the people there. And because nowadays no one is talking about these aspects of his background. Even his name is now changed, because
changed,
he was known as Julani now, even like Al Jazeera TV channel prefers to call him Ahmed al-Shara. You know, this is a new name, a new face, a new era. And let's be realistic, things have changed actually. These groups in 2012, 13, 14, 15, what they did was really shocking.
Sure.
And everyone was expecting that they will repeat the same. But this time, when they started their mobilization of the forces from Idlib towards Aleppo and from Aleppo towards Hama and then Homs and then Damascus, things changed.
Right.
I myself, I was expecting, I was waiting to see how they are going to deal with the people, with the, like with the Shias, with the Alawis, with the Christians. So at the very beginning, there were some, you know, some small events here and there. But generally speaking, what we got in this recent move, that they have changed. At least their face is now changed.
Sure, sure.
Let's be very clear on that. I don't believe that their takfiri, you know, when we call these groups takfiri, you know, this is a mixture of different groups in Syria. Sure. That's what, like, more than 35, 36 groups are there. They are mixed with each other. Mm. In the same here, Tahrir al-Sham, for example, we have a group related and known to Nuruddin al-Zanki, which is one of the worst cases of a terrorist takfiri group. They have they have beheaded, you know, children in front of their parents, literally speaking. This is their background. And they were in this. They were a part of that. We have global jihadists, specifically from this Turk line, starting from Xinjiang of China. Mm. Then you have Uzbeks, then you have Tajiks, you have Turks. So all of these, you know, people from these backgrounds are there. They are not hidden. They are just villagers.
Sure.
They are typically with press, you know, jackets.
Yeah.
And they are doing, like, media activists, actually. So they don't dare to speak Turkish or Persian, the Tajik ones, or Uzbeks. Uzbeks are speaking Uzbek language, so they are really open. It's a mixture of all of them. But at the top, it was Mohammed al-Julani who started to show himself a new leader. He started this transformation of the face when he was in Idlib. They started ruling on Idlib almost from 2017, and it this is their final stage. Of course, in Idlib, they had that rule of Sharia from their own perspective. Everything was very strict. But even at that time, they tried to make a new face. They invited even members of the European Parliament to prove them that we are not against human rights. And we are not modern. And this has one big reason. And that big reason is Turkey. Actually, this is Turkey behind them. So I believe we are facing a Turkish mind, actually. A Turkish intelligence, a Turkish mind is guiding them. And they have guided them very properly. Let's be very frank on that. I mean, they know how.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Turkey has supported them. The day that they took the control of Aleppo, Turks came. They helped them. Even they sent for them logistics, like wheat for bread, like electricity, like there were power plants in Aleppo.
Aleppo, yeah.
In brackets, that power plant of Aleppo was built by Iranians, but the problem was their fuel, and the corruption also was there. That was a problem. So the Turks came with fuel, and they run the same project, so people got electricity. So the feeling, the general feeling of the people was like that. If you ask me, what is the stand of the Syrian people towards these things? I believe they are observers. Majority of them are observers. Why? What's my proof for that? Look at the number of people who were staying in the cities and the number of people who were fleeing from the cities. Like in Aleppo,
there were more people staying in the cities than
in Aleppo, like 20% stayed, and around 70 to 80% escaped, actually. No one was knowing what's going to take place. The same took place in Hama, but Hama, the point in Hama was that because Hama had that opposition since 80s, you know, Hama was the place where that, you know, that confrontation of the you know, Islamic movements with Hafez al-Assad took place in Hama.
Yeah, the father of Bashar al-Assad.
The father. And they claim that a big massacre was took place over there. And also, if you go to the roots of that massacre, you will find that the same people were those who massacred Alawites of the army, the separated Alawites from the rest, and they, you know, killed them. So the bloodshed was there. Here I have said this again and again in different issues. The context of Syria, unfortunately, was mixed with the bloodshed, you know. And the system that was ruling upon Syria was Ba'ath Party. Ba'ath Party, sure. We have two experiences of Ba'ath Party.
Yeah, one is Saddam.
One was Saddam and one was Syria. Both were, you know, very tough. I mean, it was like the intelligence, the police, jails. And this is what we see also. Yeah. This was there. This was, and this is unfortunately a general phenomenon, I believe, at this region. If you look at the other countries also, you feel you find the same. I mean, it's not just Syria that was facing that dictatorship, so-called. For example.
Sure. No, I mean, if you go to even to Egypt, even
Egypt present was the same. Saudi Arabia is the same. Mm. Bahrain is the same. Yeah, I mean, you don't find even a single Arab. There are some like you know. Exceptions like Lebanon, like Tunisia, unless you go to the Morocco, is the same. Even Algeria, the overall situation of the freedom of speech and these values, human rights values, they are almost the same. But the problem with the Syrian case was like in 2011, when the uprising started at that time, very fast it was deviated by the flood of the money and the weapons that entered and the groups, the jihadi groups from across the globe entered. And this is where Iran stood with Syria.
In 2011.
In 2011, 2012. In 2011 was the ignition of the events in Syria. Gradually, when things became, you know, out of the control of the government, they asked for help. Iranians went there. Mm. I've said this again and again. Why Iranians went there? Three main reasons are there, very important, because if you do not understand what took place in 2011, 12, 13, you will not be able to understand what has taken place now. Yeah. So there will be a sort of contradiction in your mind that why Iran was there at that time when why Iran is not now there.
And superficially is not there now.
Mm. Exactly. The first one was that Syria was facing terrorism. Mm. I mean, groups from different parts of the world, with savage acts, with, you know, strange things were taking place. The images that they came
from. Burning people alive.
And keep in brackets, from 2013, we have Daesh there, ISIS. But before that, there was Al-Qaeda. And before Al-Qaeda, there was Jaish al-Hur, Free Syrian Army. Generally speaking, the acts on ground were like each other. They were beheading people, regardless of the title that they had. They were beheading the people because they were like religious people or secular people. The acts on ground, I think, if you Google that picture of the Syrian opposition who is cutting this chest of Syrian army and
taking he took out the liver out
the liver
and he bit it
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
the guy was not a Daesh. Yeah. The guy was not a Nusra. He was Free Syrian Army. Mm. He was a Free Syrian was a secular
group. Yeah, it was considered a moderate
and
by the American
it was supported
government.
By European countries. Mm. The guy was a member of FSA.
Yeah,
you see?
And he was doing, so they were all the same, regardless of the label.
So the first point was these images, these events that Syria was facing. The second was the traditional connections between Syria and Iran. Syria and Iran had agreements, strategic agreements, security agreements. And you should know that when in the 90s, Saddam Hussein attacked Iran and imposed war.
Syria
was the only country. Syria was actually the only country that helped Iranians. All the Arab nations were in support of Saddam. They either sent to Saddam
weapons or oil or money,
soldiers, and you know, Iranians had around prisoners of war from 20 nations.
Wow.
In Iranian fronts, when Iranians were conquering some fronts and they were getting victory over the Iraqi Ba'ath Party at that time forces. So they were getting officers from Egypt, from Jordan, from African countries. And those countries who were not there with their personnel, they were helping Saddam, like Kuwait, like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
they were funding
oil,
Saddam.
Petrodollars.
And the only country, being an Arab country, that supported Iran, stood with Iran, was Syria of Hafez al-Assad. And the third point, and that resulted in, you know, ties, very close ties between Iranians and the Syrians. And the third point, which is the most important part, is about Palestine.
Sure.
Syria was the only Arab state. I don't talk about the nations and the groups. Syria was the only Arab state standing firm in support of Palestine. We had three main Arab states that supported Palestine.
Yeah.
Egypt, from 1948. Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. In 1967 war, when all these Arab countries were defeated by Israel at that time, Egypt faced, after that war, so many changes. Jamal Abdel Nasser died, passed away, and after that Anwar Sadat came, the war of 1973, and that resulted at the end in the agreement of Camp David in 1978.
Yeah, the Camp David Accords.
The Camp David Accords, 1978. And after that, Anwar Sadat traveled to Israel, went to Tel Aviv, and delivered a speech at the Israeli Knesset. That was
the end of,
that was the end
Egyptian
of the Egyptian
state.
Egyptian state
support
in support of
Palestine.
The Palestinian. From there, the misery of the Arab world started. It continued. 1992, the Madrid agreement and peace talks, and then 1993,
the
Oslo peace accord. That resulted in normalization of ties of Jordan with
Israel.
And the remaining country was Syria, that stood firm. Syrians did not change their policy towards Palestine from 1948. Yes, there is one thing. In 1967, Syria lost Golan Heights. Got that they were lost, they were under the control of the Israelis. In 1973, they tried to regain some of those, some parts of the Golan Heights, but again, Israelis took the control of those heights. But after the agreement of the denormalization of the Egyptians, which was the main backbone of the Arab world, Arab army, Arab power at the region, after that, actually all Arab countries were on a decline. They, from almost 1973, no Arab nation, no Arab state had that power of fighting against Israel. So Syria also was among them. Syria became really weak. They were not capable of fighting back against Israelis who were supported by Western countries. You take in consideration all the events that took place at that time. So Syrians were not there to start a war against Israel or take Golan Heights back because they were in a lower position. That's the reality. Those who are asking why Syria is not fighting for Jordan, brother, Syria was weak. That's the reality. But they did not change their stand. They said, okay, if we can't do anything, we will not prevent the resistant forces
from helping and supporting Palestine.
So they paved the path and they prepared the ground for the Palestinian fraction and the resistant fractions. And from that point, all the resistant factions we have in 1982-83, Jihad al-Islami, and 1988, Harkat al-Muqawamat al-Islamiyya, Hamas, and in the same time, Hezbollah. So actually, Damascus became the headquarter of the resistance. All these groups were active in Damascus. And Damascus paved the path for Iranians to help the resistance also. And this is why you were saying other Arab countries, in Jordan and in Egypt, they normalized their ties with Israel. Talking about resistance was a crime. People were arrested because any connection to resistance. But Syria was not the case. And Syria paid a price for that. Syria was under sanctions. Syria was under pressure. Syria was under attack, continuous attack. But Syrians did not surrender. And I say you, the Syrians, the Syria that was run by Assad, till the last point did not surrender on that time. Till 2 days ago when Damascus fell. Syrians were, of course, the situation was totally different. They had so many more problems at that time. So because of that, Iranians stood with the Syrians because they were understanding that this is the route, this is the connection to the resistance. So that's why Iranians resisted over there. In the first point that I mentioned, which was the groups, one of the main concerns of Iran at that time was the issue of the minorities and Shias who were in Syria and the shrine of Lady Zainab also there. Because these groups were like openly telling that they are going to destroy the shrine. So Iran entered. All these factors, keeping in mind all these factors, Iran entered. Iran resisted. Iran helped. Because Syrians decided to resist. At that time, Erdogan came to Tehran. He met Ayatollah Khamenei, Imam Khamenei, and talked to him. And he told the Iranians, let's talk about Syria after Bashar. Iranians said, no. Bashar wants to resist. His army is going to resist. And the Syrians will resist and we'll help them. And Iran did that. And it was successful. But the point is that...
So you were going to talk about the difference. So what is the difference now?
Exactly.
That is where you were going.
This time, the problem this time is that, first of all, when this invasion started from Idlib towards Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Damascus, first of all, the nature of these groups changed. Was different. At least what they were showing from themselves changed. They were not beheading people, at least normal people. There were some videos, I don't want to deny. Yeah,
sporadic.
But it's very limited. Mm. Generally speaking, even what took place to the people of Nubal al-Zahra, they escaped at the very beginning, then they returned back. So this paved the path for their progress also. This is one thing. Second was, and the main point is here, I believe, that the Syrian army and the Syrian government, because of different factors, was not capable of resisting against these groups. The general economic crisis that they faced, let's not forget the Caesar
sanctions
by Americans on Syria. That was, you know,
backbreaking,
really backbreaking for the Syrians. A top level general in the Syrian army was getting like $100 per month. That was the whole. I mean, that was typical army were like $20 per month. This was their, you know, income. So this resulted in actually.
Sometimes, Sayed, I'm sorry, because I think this is a very interesting number that you brought up, that the individual, I'm sorry, is getting $100 a month, right? In the larger, you know, scope, that's nothing. And still, for such a low price that you would sell out your country, you would sell out your people, you would sell out your government, you would sell out your values, it's quite unfortunate and shocking.
That's the point. Yeah. And unfortunately, this is the problem with the ideology of Ba'ath Party. Ba'ath Party is not an ideal, is not an Islamic ideology.
Yeah, well, it's a nationalistic, Arab nationalism.
It's nationalistic, actually. And the point here is that, for a soldier who wants to resist, at least there should be either ideology,
ideological,
or economy.
Yeah.
When you have lost both of them.
Yeah.
And there are, of course, some mistakes. Like Iranians helped Syrians to make Jaysh al-Difa' al-Watani, which was something like Hashd al-Sha'bi, mostly from the Alawites, because they had that ideology of, at least for yourself, I mean, when you are, you know, Syrian army at that time were resisting, because they were thinking that even if they don't have that ideology, Islamic ideology, they were thinking that if this guy come, either I will fight back, or either I will survive, or I will kill him. But if he takes the control, he will behead me for sure.
Yeah, right.
This time that was not the case. So they were telling if our country is under that level of pressure, and generally speaking, they lost that will of resisting. This is one part. They were dependent on Iranians and on Russians for their
a lot of their military capabilities.
It's analysis. It's my analysis.
Sure.
Russians were highly involved in Ukraine war. And Iranians were highly involved in Tufan al-Aqsa. Iranians, Hezbollah, they were concentrating on Tufan al-Aqsa. This is what Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday told. Clearly, he went to Golan Heights, he spoke, he made a video over there, and he said clearly that we made it, we Israelis made it, because we weakened Iran and Hezbollah as the main supporters of the Syrian government, and then you revolutionary guys were capable of, in a series of actions, you took the control. That's a reality. Iran was highly involved with Tufan al-Aqsa. Russians were highly involved in Ukraine. Russians, I think, had some, you know, optimism towards Trump coming to the rule.
Some backdoor
Those things are possible. Yeah. And generally speaking, what I get from different signals, those who met with Bashar al-Assad in the past 10 days, they were telling that Bashar has lost his confidence on his own army. So when you lost that confidence on your own army,
Then there's nobody left to protect the country or protect you, so why die alone?
Iranians, let's not forget, look, Iran has a policy at the region. Now Iran stepped back. Is this a defeat? Yes, it's a defeat. It's a defeat. But it's not, I mean, we have not lost everything. There were a series of events and routes that resulted in this event to take place, but I will elaborate more on that. I will tell you. But things were also changed. Let's not forget, this was not like that, like before. There was a concern about the Shia, there was a concern about the shrines. Based on different dikes, it seems that at least till now, nothing has taken place. At least they have kept their promises, because Iranians tried to get some guarantees from them, from Turks, that Shia's shrines will be protected. And the third one is about Iran, Hezbollah, Iran resistance connection. That one I don't believe will change.
Will change
that
yeah.
one is the loss that we face. But alhamdulillah speaking, now the life of the Shia Zawadiyah, the situation of the shrines of Hazrat Sakina and Hazrat Zainab, we hope. Nothing can be confirmed. I don't know what take place tomorrow because specifically these groups are not just one group. There are so many, groups mixed which are in under this general banner of HTS. Iranian policy at the region was to support and help anyone who wants to confront the Americans and the Zionist strategies and policies at the region. This is the general policy of Iran.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's about resistance. Palestinians want to resist, Iran is there to help them. If you want to resist, we will help you.
If you don't want to resist, then how are we supposed to help you?
Lebanese, if you want to resist, we'll help you. Syrians, Yemenis, Iraqis, Iran is very clear on that. Ayatollah Khamenei said it very clearly. Anyone who wants to confront the Israeli regime, we are there to help them. But if you do not want to do that, what should Iran do?
Yeah.
Iran is not going to fight.
We can't force anybody to resist.
This is very important, a request of our audience. Pay attention to this part, because this is the answer to the question somehow telling that if Iran is capable of firing missiles on Israel, why Iran is not completely
firing missiles in Syria.
And ending the war and ending the war on Gaza? Because Iranians are not there to fight instead of Palestinians. Iranians are there to help the Palestinians. If there is one single Palestinian, even one single Palestinian, believing in resistance, Iran will help that Palestinian. And even in the case of Syria, Iranians did not leave Syria, like some are telling Iran. No, Iranians remain until the last army of the Syrian army, Arab army, was fighting. Iranians were with them. But when they withdrew, Iranians also left. That's the point.
Yeah.
We can't do anything. We can't fight instead of you. That's the difference. If a country is going to fight instead of someone, that will be like Blackwater. That will be like Wagner's. No, Iranians are not Wagner. Iranian IRGC is not Wagner, is not Blackwater. Iranians are there to support anyone who wants to resist against Americans and against Israel. In different cases, there were those groups who were against Iran, who were considering Iran to be, I don't know, Majusi, Shia, like the things.
Yeah.
But they were against Americans. Iranians helped them. It may be shocking for some of our audience.
Sure,
in some cases, they were telling that, okay, Iranians, give us the weapon, but don't enter our home because we are considering you to be najis. But we will use this weapon against Americans. Iranians were there to help them. They were okay, don't care. Like the connections that Iranians had with different groups who were not considering Iran as their friend.
Yeah.
But the only common point was that they were against Israel. They were against American occupation of forces of the region. Iran said, okay, we'll help you. Regardless of your ideology towards us, we'll help you. That's the key
this
point.
This idea of resistance and supporting the resistance.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and Iran did the same. In Syria, Iran stood to the last moment. Iran tried to secure the shrines of Lady Zainab and the situation of the Shias over there also, based my own connection into Syria. Alhamdulillah, they are safe till now, and I hope that they will be safe, inshallah. And on the issue of resistance, this is the main concern of Iran. Iranians said it from the very beginning. The most important factor for which Iranians entered in Syria was to keep this lifeline backup for the resistance.
Sure.
This is now somehow we can consider being interrupted. At least till now. We have to see what will take place in future.
Yeah.
But till now, it's interrupted. And that is because we believe the whole event that took place was a part of the plan and the strategy that Americans did. Don't misunderstand. I don't say that Mohammed al-Julani is a CIA agent. No. No, sometimes when we are analyzing, we are telling that these groups are acting in such a way that is resulting in favor of, this is what we said about Al-Qaeda. Sometimes there is a foundation. Foundation of Al-Qaeda was based on Salafiyah, jihadi takfiri Salafi movement. That was because of the USSR occupying Afghanistan. They went to Afghanistan to fight them. There, they said, okay, if you want to fight against USSR, let's get help from Russians, from Americans also. So Americans funded them, gradually infiltrated in them, and make use of them for their own general
agendas.
For their
own purposes,
purposes and agendas. And that is a problem with these takfiri groups. And I consider them being naive. The problem with them is that they don't have an understanding, a proper understanding of America.
Well, what's interesting, this guy Jolani, for example, I'm not sure, I can't quote him, but one of the Israeli news channels, they quoted one of the militant commanders saying that if we come into control in Syria, we won't have any problem with Israel. We don't plan on fighting Israel. Matter of fact, we want to be good neighbors with Israel.
Yeah.
This is one of the... So this idea that you're saying that not only are they naive...
This, I believe, is actually not authentic. None of the official leaders and heads of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham has commented like that. There are Syrian opposition forces from different other fractions who have actually... been on Israeli channels, talked with them, but not Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. This is one thing. Second, based on the facts on ground, we have some facts telling that groups linked to Jabhat al-Nusra, which was also related to the same, which was the roots of the same Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, because it was before named as Jabhat al-Nusra. Groups linked to Jabhat al-Nusra were in Jolan, and they were treated by the Israelis. They were taken, they had injuries, and Israelis took them to their hospitals. It was about Jabhat Tahrir, it was about Jabhat al-Nusra. Jabhat al-Nusra. But we don't have official statement of these people in favor of Israel up till now. Actually, they have not done any statement on Israel. Not in favor of Israel and not against Israel also, taking consideration. Yesterday, Muhammad al-Jolani made a speech in Jami al-Umawi, in the Umawi Mosque in Damascus. When he was delivering the speech, Israel was bombarding Damascus and other parts of Syria. Israel tanks entered al-Qunaytara for the first time after 1974 agreement that they had after the war of 1973. They entered the Syrian side. They occupied actually the Syrian side. They occupied Mount Hermon, which is one of the mountains in Jabal al-Sheikh range of the mountains. Israel occupied, attacked, and Israel is not going to return back. We know how Israel is playing always. But Mr. Jolani said not even a single word.
This is what I'm saying here. This is the analysis. So he attacks Iran, but while the Zionist regime is taking more of your land, your name is Jolani, and you don't even have.
You belong to Jolan.
You belong to Jolan, and they're taking that from under your nose. You know, to me, these are clear signs that where it, these people it, lie it, it, in it, the political equation.
The day that Netanyahu started his ground invasion on Lebanon, he talked about a basic change in the region. He talked, we are going to change the face of the region. Okay, then he started the attack on Lebanon. They titled that attack Operation of Resurrection, if you remember, you know?
Operation Resurrection.
It means like...
It's a new life.
Things are going to be changed at the region. At the region, not at Lebanon. They attacked Lebanon, but they were talking about region.
About the region.
That's how I analyzed that operation, that 2 months of operation was a failure for Israel because they did not achieve. But the point here is that, so what was that interpretation of that changing the region? They signed an agreement, so it means they were cooking something.
Yeah, they're definitely cooking something.
The operation that they did, here are the signs, we have to go deep. The operation that they did from Aleppo, from Idlib to Aleppo, it needs preparation. How is it possible to mobilize tons of them?
With that amount of speed and that amount of weaponry
When they were preparing those operations, at the same time that Hezbollah was fighting in that front, Netanyahu was openly telling that we helped them by weakening, engaging Hezbollah and Iran with the war so that you know, these guys, what are telling that? No, we had good intention unless we could have started the operation before the ceasefire agreement. Yeah. No, brother. You started, I'm telling brother to you. They started this operation the day that Hezbollah was in need of support.
Sure.
So they're trying to change the whole system of region. Of course, I believe there is a bigger plan going on.
Yeah.
NATO is there. Turkey is there. Americans are there. Israel is there. Kurds that have control almost one-fourth or one-third of the country on the eastern bank of the Euphrates River are a part of that equation as well. You know, let's not forget, yet they have not controlled those areas. So when you take all these things at your consideration, it seems that you are not going to do anything against Israel. Even if you say the day after tomorrow something against Israel, let's hope that our analysis is going to be wrong. We would be really happy that if our analysis is wrong. And you start a front in Jolan. Be sure the day you give any signal of resisting against Israel, Iran will be with you.
Yeah.
Iran will be with you. I mean, that's not the point. I mean, for Iran, Iran has said and proved that. And you know better than everyone else that Iran is there to fight against. But the point is that we understand that this is all a NATO-backed plan, and they will not let you to harm Israel.
Yeah, no, they won't let you. Sayed, I wanted to kind of, because we went over time, but I want to close on this idea of social media and the influence of social media, right? So we've seen that immediately these reports and sometimes contradictory reports, Assad is alive, Assad is dead, Assad's in Russia, Assad's still in Syria, you know, that the Russians and the Syrian army together have killed over 2,000 of these Takfiri terrorists. And they're so, and then, you know, within the first few days, you know, Damascus has fallen, Aleppo has fallen, when a lot of this stuff had not happened yet. But the impact of social media in the present day and how it really affects wars and people's perceptions and what the reality on the ground is, you know, and to be careful about where you get your information from.
Yeah, that's really important. So many believe that one of the reasons that they were, you know, these groups were, you know, the progress that was very fast was because of their social media campaign, actually, because they use that in a proper way.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
And they try to portray an image of themselves that we are very powerful, coming fast. Meanwhile, in most of the cases, there was not a real front line between them and between those who were supposed to defend. And actually, that's why the Syrian army left without actually confrontation. The last one was in Homs. That once they tried to enter, they were pushed back by the resistance forces. And then next time when they tried to pass, they were not trying to confront. If they were getting any sort of resistance at any city, they were trying to cover it from other routes, not to confront and go forward. You know, in so many of those areas that they were skipping, actually no resistance, they were not facing, they did not fight any war there, actually. Not even one bullet was fired several times because of that psychological war that was going on. So sometimes you are actually helping the enemy if you are following those trends. That's really important. I mean, from where you are getting the information, not trusting any platform, anything. You have to try, you have to be actually wise nowadays. If you're getting an image, if you're getting a video, is this a real video, is it a fake, is it for today or for years back? Where's the location? Is it here or somewhere else? I mean, there are so many questions that you have to think again and again to find out is that reality or not. And that's unfortunately part of the problem we are facing today. You know, everyone is affected by social media, and social media could have negative effects of that sort, even in the sense to, I mean, times such as wars, really.
Yeah, and Sayed, you know, I think one last thing to close up, because a lot of people across the world, especially the people that believe in the resistance and the ideology of the resistance, you know, the ideology of the Islamic Revolution, they have this concern that, you know, that the resistance has been weakened, that, you know, this is going downhill from now, this means that the enemy is winning. When in reality, when we look at the ideological aspect, the resistance is an ideology, that you can never destroy. It lives within the hearts of the people, it lives within the people. It's interesting, the foreign minister, Araghchi, yesterday, he said something interesting. He said, sure, if, for example, our military route through Syria into Palestine has been cut and that this is going to end everything, he says, we don't have any military routes towards Yemen.
And Gaza.
And look at the people Gaza. Of Yemen and Gaza as well. Look at them. It is the resistance of the people. So to give this hope that the resistance is not something that you can destroy by changing a government.
More than that, resistance is natural. It's about of the nature of human being. Mm. And that's why we believe what Iran is saying is it will not, it's forever. What Iran says that region is that the presence of the Israeli regime, the Zionist regime in the region, is against the will and the wish of the people of this
region.
Against the interests of the people of this region.
Yeah.
It's not all about ideology. It's it's about human beings there.
Yeah. Yeah.
The presence of Israel is there to be a hegemonic power, to suppress all other nations.
Mm.
That's why we believe if even a single Palestinian is going to remain and remain alive after this genocide, he will resist, she will resist. Resist is in the nature of any newborn baby in Gaza, in nature of any person in South Lebanon, in the nature of anyone. It's quite natural. Yeah, there may be ups and downs.
Yeah
today
downs.
We may not have that access of before in Syria. But don't be worried. I really believe on that.
Yeah.
Really believe.
Yeah.
What Iran says is that if the people of this region want to have a better life, there is no other way for them to put an end to this regime. Because this regime is there to suppress all the resources, all the you know, benefits and the profits of the region in favor of their own bigger agenda, bigger Israel, you know. And that's why we believe these ups and downs will go. Let's wait and see what will be the result of this change in Syria, that I'm not optimistic about that. And I'm sure that very bad scenarios could take place. God forbid, I really hope good for the people of Syria. I don't want bloodshed there.
Inshallah.
But when I'm looking to the ground situation, when I'm looking at the Americans, what the plans and plots of Americans are with the Kurds, what the Turks are thinking on that, what the Israelis are doing on South, I'm not optimistic that these things will result at anything for the people of Syria. As long as Israel is there, there will be misery for the people of the region. And that's what Iran is telling. Iran is telling you, I'm there to help you because this is in favor of me and you. This is a common issue for all of the nations of the region.
In the region. Well, I want to end at one thing. I kept on saying I want to end.
This is the third end.
Yeah, this is the third end. Imam Syed Ali Khamenei, I think in May of this year, he had already said something about Syria. He said to be very careful for these new plots that are going to be done by the Western powers against Syria, in which they're going to start to make you promises. One of the things is to make promises that they're going to break. So again, this idea that this false trust and this false faith that continuously we're stuck in, where we keep on trusting the United States of America, we keep on trusting Britain, in some places we keep on trusting Israel. So for example, the Saudis were about to normalize, but then the whole Al-Aqsa storm happened and then they got scared, you know, but the Bahrainis, they normalized, the UAE normalized, right? Turkey is one of the countries that provides oil pretty much without any question to Israel. Jordan is pretty much normalized, right? Egypt, you were telling us, they're also normalized. And so this idea of, you know, we need to finally wake up, stop trusting these, you know, either traitorous Arab leaders or these, you know, open enemy of the Muslims, whether it's America, the UK or Israel, that we need to open our eyes and realize these realities.
Yeah, I mean, I believe if after
After
genocide and massacre of like more than 50,000 Palestinians, people are not going to open their eyes. What should we do? What is the bigger logic? You have like 20,000 kids in Palestine massacred by the Israelis, and massacred by Israelis and Americans.
Yeah.
America was not there to support Israelis. America was a part of this genocide.
Yes.
America was complicit exactly. I mean, in all sense, I mean, weapons were there. Soldiers were on ground there. American soldiers were there on ground. American advisors were there on ground. American CENTCOM was there to protect Israel. I mean, this all is taking place. If yet, it's not a matter of America, Britain. It's a matter of believing in the Western civilization, brother.
Yeah, yeah.
The genocide in Gaza is the result and outcome of a civilization. Israel is claiming to be the real representative of the Western values in Israel is true. They are the representatives of Western value in our region. But this is that Western value, a Western value that really dehumanizes us. They don't believe, I told it once, several times, that it is not a matter of double standards. When Westerns are talking about human rights and implementing in their own case in another way, when it comes to us another way, it's not a matter of double standards.
It's their belief.
It's a matter that when they describe the human beings, they excluded we Easterns from that category of human beings. So I don't consider that being a double standard. I consider that it's a matter of dehumanization. When the humanism was a trend in West, they dehumanized us. And there are so many examples on that.
Sure, sure.
And that's the point. We have to be really, really, you have to awake. This is the civilization. The whole structure in front of us is supporting Israelis, and genocide is going on. What we have in our hand? A persecution, variant of like ICC, that's it. Okay, that's good, okay, at least.
But it's definitely nowhere close to what's being.
Like as Imam Khomeini said, we need to see these guys being punished.
Capital punishment.
They should be killed hanged. They should be killed because of all the atrocities that they did, all the genocide that they're committing day by day. Understanding anything to them.
Jazakallah, thank you so much. Sayyid, thank you for joining us, inshallah. We hope to have you on another talk show.
And
very interesting, about the recent developments in Syria and some of the history of the region as well. May Allah bless you. And we hope to see you on another talk show soon, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Jazakallah, thank you so much, dear viewers, for joining us on the Islamic Pulse talk show. We were talking about some recent developments in Syria, some of the historical background, and perhaps some of the things that might happen in the future. That's all from us for now. Fi amanillah and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wherever you are.